Good evening, and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Monday, October 16th, 2017. A shooting rampage in northern Kenya reportedly started out by a South Sudanese student.
Maybe your parents or something, but when he went back, he came and attacked the school.
And a shootout between youth and police in Rumbek.
It was like 3 hours fighting. Five policemen were killed, four men and one woman. They were killed on the spot. And among the youths, it was that one man who was killed, the one who was killed, which provoked the situation.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudanese and northern Kenyan authorities say a South Sudanese youth killed six people and wounded more than a dozen others during an attack on a school in Lokujio, northern Kenya. The South Sudanese student reportedly mobilized other youth and attacked the school on Friday after the young man was suspended by administrators for disciplinary issues. Dimo Silva Aurelio has the details for VOA from Juba.
A young man believed to be from South Sudan's Kapweta estate gunned down five students and a security guard at Lokichogyo African Inland Church Secondary School near the South Sudan-Kenya border on Friday. 16 others were wounded. Kenyan authorities say school officials suspended the South Sudanese student from the school after he fought with a colleague. Authorities told the youth to return to school with his parents or a guardian. Lodwar District Police Officer Geoffrey Onjaka says instead of returning with his parents, the youth came back to the school with a handful of friends and went on a shooting rampage.
He was suspended, including the other students from Kenya. They were both suspended. They can bring maybe their parents or something. But when he went back, he came and attacked the school.
Jafar Lowara, Commissioner of South Sudan's Losolia County, says the shooter was apprehended by police, but a mob wrestled the man away from officers and burned him alive.
He came nigh to the compound of the school where the female is sleeping. He attacked the compound. He started by killing the watchman. He died and 16 injured. We heard that story from Kenya, and he was arrested. He was arrested in Kakuma, and he was burned by fire.
Officer Onjaka says the suspects also raped two students in the girls' dormitory. He says police arrested some suspects who were taken to a police station in Kakuma. Lowara says residents of Kapweta estate, where the suspects are from, fear there will be reprisal attacks.
Civilians of these Narus and Kapweta were worried that something may happen to their children. But up to now, I can say nothing bad happened apart from this suspect.
Lowara says Kenyan and South Sudanese officials are working together to prevent violence between South Sudan's Toposa and Kenya's Turkana communities, both of which are pastoralists. He says local leaders on both sides of the border will continue to talk to both communities to ensure they remain calm. Kapweta State Information Minister Felix Makuja confirms the shooting rampage and the lynching took place, but says it has been difficult to establish communication with Kenyan authorities because of what he called the bad mood of people in Lokichogyo. Makuja offered the condolences of the Kapweta State government to the families who lost their loved ones during Friday's attack. Earlier this year, religious leaders from both countries met in Lodwar, Kenya, to talk about the proliferation of small arms and how to reduce long-standing border conflicts between communities of South Sudan's Toposa, Kenya's Turkana, Uganda's Karamoja, and Ethiopia's Nyangatom pastoralist communities. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
And there was more bloodshed over the weekend. Officials say at least six people were killed and two others wounded during a shootout between police and youth from an armed militia group in Rumbek of Western Lake State. As Michael Atit reports from Juba, an eyewitness says the attack went on for 3 hours.
An eyewitness tells South Sudan in Focus a total of five police officers were killed, including a female officer. But the state officials say only one policeman and one armed youth were killed during the incident. 26-year-old Raphael Makwei resides in Rumbek. Makwei says it is all began when two armed youth entered Rumbek town and a policeman tried to disarm one of the youths. When the young man refused the officer's order to throw down his weapon, Makwei says the officer shot and killed him. He says the second young man tried to shoot at the officer, who then ran to nearby police station for cover.
So one policeman shot one instantly, and that one collapsed and died on spot. And then the second one was shooting at the police, but the police took off into the plantation. So that survivor tried to follow the police into the plantation, but failed. Then the police came back out of the plantation. They picked the gun, because this man was carrying two guns, the one who was killed. Police took the two guns, and then they took off with the guns.
Makwei says the youth then mobilized and attacked a police station, and for the next 3 hours, Rumbek youth and police were engaged in shootout.
It was like 3 hours fighting. Five policemen were killed, four men and one woman. They were killed on the spot. And among the youths, it was that one man who was killed, the one who was killed which provoked the situation.
Western Lake State Information Minister Shadrack Bol Machok confirmed the shootout occurred, but insists only one police officer was killed. Speaking by phone from Rumbek town today, Bol says the government deployed hundreds of soldiers to Rumbek and the area is now calm.
The civilians who were in confrontation with the policemen have withdrawn to their area, and their elders have gone to where they are. They have been advised not to go for further confrontation with the police. So they have accepted it, and now there is no problem in the town. The town is very much safe.
Bol called it an isolated incident and urged Galweng youth to remain calm.
It should not be mistaken for the government that there may be a plan by the government to fight a certain faction. That is not there.
Isaac Majir, the head of the Civil Society Alliance in Greater Lakes, condemned the incident and blames police for the loss of life.
They also need to be trained on how they can be able to apprehend or to stop someone who is a civilian, whether he or she has a gun or not. And instead of just killing right away, it's like you have already judged. That is a capital punishment already.
Majer says civilians must never take law into their hands.
Always we call for legal procedures in order to resolve an issue that might cause problems between or among the population. We regret all the efforts that we have put forward to encourage the civil population to be law-abiding citizens.
Minister Bol called on residents to remain calm and follow all legal procedures rather than resorting to the reprisal attack. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
Members of the National Dialogue Steering Committee say they fear fighting will continue across the country after former First Vice President Riek Machar refused to meet them in South Africa last week. It's the second time the group came to see Machar. One of the officials who traveled to South Africa to consult with Machar says his group believes that it will be difficult to end hostilities in the country unless Machar is involved in the national dialogue. For VOA News, Tito Justin reports from Juba.
About 20 members of the National Dialogue Steering Committee and Secretariat returned to Juba over the weekend after failing to meet with Machar. South Sudan in Focus tried to reach Machar and his advisor several times last week without success. Angelo Beda, co-chairperson of the National Dialogue Steering Committee, says Machar declined to meet his group.
I think the reason is that he prefers a revitalization of the peace agreement to national dialogue. And we have said again and again that there is no conflict between national dialogue and the revitalization. You can join it and you can send your people here, and that one, if it succeeds, we want to stop the war in Southern Sudan. That is our immediate aim, which is the same aim of the revitalization.
After fighting erupted last July between Machar's forces and government forces, Machar fled the capital. In the interim, Machar has repeatedly called for the review of security and power-sharing arrangements and has expressed support for revitalizing the IGAD brokered August 2015 peace agreement. Betty Achan Aguero, deputy co-chair of the National Dialogue Steering Committee, says Machar's repeated refusal to meet with her team will only prolong the country's ongoing war.
The impact we can see is his supporters may continue to fight while we are actually fighting to stop the violence. So one reason why we wanted Dr. Riak to meet the team is to express himself. Because once he expresses himself, this will be known to everybody why he is not happy. But when he doesn't express himself and his supporters outside continue to fight, this, of course, will prevent us from reaching areas that we want to reach.
In May, President Salva Kiir ordered all government forces to cease fire to create an atmosphere conducive for holding a national dialogue, but the fighting did not stop. Lual Achwek, a member of the National Dialogue Secretariat, warns it will be impossible to restore peace in South Sudan unless Machar participates in the dialogue.
How do you stop the cessation of hostilities if you are not talking? So the process and experiences from other countries is when all people come together and they agree on the steps what need to be done. So Dr. Riek has to be on board first in order to stop the cessation of hostilities.
Despite Machar's refusal to meet with the steering committee, Beda says committee members will continue to meet with the other groups to convince Machar and other armed groups that it's their best interest to take part in the dialogue.
We announced in Pretoria, we announced in Cape Town that our door is left open for Riek Machar to come and join us, and we shall go again to meet him. We are going ahead after our congress is finished, our consultation is finished, and we produce a document. We shall take it to give it to South Africa and give it to Riak and call him to come again.
In June, foreign envoys in South Sudan said they would fund the proposed national dialogue on condition that the government first ends the fighting. Beda says the steering committee will not give up on its effort until the objectives of restoring peace and stability across South Sudan are met. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Are escalating dowry prices leading to more violence? Find out when we come back.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what do you love about Africa?
It's about the nature and the green about it, and then the hospitality it has.
Africa's got tremendous mountains, rivers, lakes, animals. The beauty of Africa itself, inviting Europeans, Australians, Asians to come and visit Africa.
I love the hair. I love the thinking. I love the brain. I love the people. I love the lands of Africa. And I love the history of Africa.
It's nature, it's beauty, weather. All is good. And the way that it favors a human being and even the growing of crops, that's food.
When I look at Africa, I most like the natural beauty of Africa. All the seas, rivers. So I'm proud to be in Africa.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Ambassador Mark Green, the administrator of USAID, just returned from a trip to East Africa, where he met South Sudan's President Salva Kiir in the capital, Juba. In an interview with VOA's Peter Clody, Ambassador Green says he told President Kiir to resolve the ongoing man-made humanitarian crisis in his country, adding that South Sudan's widespread food insecurity is directly tied to the ongoing fighting.
So they're man-made and they can be man-prevented and solved. In my meeting with President Kiir, I was very clear that what we find there is completely unacceptable. The level of danger to humanitarian workers, most dangerous place in the world for humanitarian workers, just the everyday crime that we see, unacceptable. And, again, they have an absolute responsibility to provide security, to make sure that humanitarian access to the camps and settlements for internally displaced people, that's an obligation that they have. And so I wanted them to know that, that we don't find it acceptable and that we not only need to see change, but on behalf of their own people, we demand to see change. And so I was pretty harsh in what I had to say.
Talking about food security in those areas, in the Horn of Africa region, Kenya, Somalia, South Sudan, and the rest, how will USAID help in this drive to ensure food security and adequate food for the people living there?
We have a program called Feed the Future, which I think is a great innovation. That comes out of the Obama administration. I'm a big supporter, big believer in it. And that helps us on the resilience side. So on one hand, there's the immediate need, and we will be there working with host country partners to provide food and water if we can to meet with immediate needs. But again, what we want to do is to apply these technologies and these tools to help people help themselves going forward. So it's a combination of those immediate needs, basic nutrition, because we all know that in a child's life, those first months are so crucial to that child's future intellectual development. We'll always be there for that. But then also working with them to take on those longer-term challenges. Nobody can predict exactly when disaster will strike, but we can take steps to protect ourselves and strengthen ourselves against the impact and the effects.
So far, how have these people reacted to some of these programs and measures that you've talked to them about?
They've embraced them. I'll give you an example of Ethiopia, where I was. I was at a food distribution, and I remember we had just provided some grain to a woman who was going to take it and divide it up for her family. And she asked me if she could ask a question. I said, sure. And her question was the perfect question. And the question was, can you help me with irrigation so I never have to do this again? I thought, that's the question. There's a woman who's trying desperately to provide for her own family, looking for help, not looking for handouts. She doesn't want to take grain. She'll take grain because her family's hungry, but what she wants to do is lead herself and her family and her community, and so embrace it. I saw a microfinance facility in the Somali region in Ethiopia in which we were helping particularly women. We have a difficult time getting credit to help them do their small businesses. I saw it doing so well that a traditional bank across the road, as I was at the microfinance facility, they were all staring down. They were not happy because everybody was doing the microfinance, a lot of it SMS-based, cell phone-based. I also saw a program that was helping farmers provide fodder for cattle, sort of counter-cycle so that they're protected when the drought occurs. And then finally, I went to a wonderful facility. It was a slaughterhouse. In the slaughterhouse, they were bringing in high-quality carcasses to be able to dress down and then provide to Middle East, selling to the Middle East. So taking that wonderful resource they have in Ethiopia, wonderful pastoral lifestyles, and they produce very high-quality meat, serving a market that provides them with real capital and hard capital that they can use for the future. So what we've seen is that people embrace these tools. Because again, the Africans that I know are like everyone else. They want to lead themselves. They don't want a hand out. They're looking for a hand up. We can help them with these tools, and they want to take care of themselves.
That's Ambassador Mark Green, ambassador of USAID, who just returned from East Africa, where he met with President Kiir. On this World Food Day, he says South Sudan's food insecurity is a direct result of the ongoing fighting in the country. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clody in Washington. In many South Sudanese communities, dowry is paid in cattle. Some residents of the Jonglei State Capital, Bor, are calling on elders to lower the bride price. In the past, parents expected about 30 head of cattle for dowry, but today the price of a bride could easily surpass 100 head of cattle. Residents say the higher dowry price encourages violence, intercommunal cattle raids, and killings. Deng Gai Deng has the story for VOA from Bor.
Residents gathered at a forum in Bor organized by the Grand Vetters Association and is sponsored by UN Women under the theme The Culture of Dowry in South Sudan and Its Implications on Gender-Based Violence. 30-year-old Bor resident Panchol Madine Ngor, who participated in today's forum, says parents are asking for a ridiculously high number of cattle from men who wish to marry their daughters.
The high dowries that enforce on youth, it gets youth discouraged and youth are also jobless. Previously it was 30, but nowadays it raised to either 300 cows or 400 cows. I, as a puncher, I can say we must reduce it to 30 such that others can afford it.
Mading Boer James Makur, deputy chairperson of the Boer Community Youth Association, says the high bride price forces young men to carry out violent cattle raids on other communities so they can marry.
Those who cannot afford can resort into cattle raiding or maybe stealing, or sometimes they can end up not marrying. And to those who have afforded marrying with so many cows, they may tend to mistreat their wives and think they have bought them.
Makur urges his community to respect all cultural norms and values, which he says encourage parents to charge a reasonable number of cattle for dowry.
And I'm urging the community actually to go back to our cultural norms and values and be able to understand what marriage is. Marriage is not about buying a lady. Marriage is about uniting the relationship of the two families to live together. And some people have actually resorted into marriage in our community today like it is a business, and it used not to be a business.
Deng Makol Malik is the Chief Finance and Administration Officer at the Grand Debaters Association. He says his group intends to use dialogue to help communities find solutions to high dowry prices and other problems.
This campaign is to sensitize our communities, especially on the culture of dowry in South Sudan and its implication on the gender-based violence, to make sure that issues that our communities suffer in silence are brought to light, and to inform them about the negative implications of the gender-based violence in their lives. Because we see tomorrow South Sudan will be better if it is free of any violence, whether in any form.
Malik says his association is trying to educate other communities about the same problem of high dowry prices and will organize similar discussion in Rumbek and Yambio. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaiding in Bor.
The death toll keeps climbing after Saturday's massive truck bombing in Mogadishu. By this afternoon, the death count topped 300, with at least 429 wounded. Analysts say the Somali government must be more vigilant against improvised explosive devices if the country is going to avoid similar attacks in the future. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
It's being called the single deadliest attack in Somalia's history. A huge truck bomb that detonated in the middle of a busy Mogadishu intersection on Saturday. Its magnitude stunned a city already well accustomed to deadly bombings by the Al-Qaeda-linked terror group Al-Shabaab. Somalia's president, Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo, accused Al-Shabaab of the attack, although no one has yet claimed responsibility. Rashid Abdi, Horn of Africa Project Director for the International Crisis Group, says the horrendous loss of life eclipses anything seen in Somalia in the last two decades. He says the government needs to take greater precautions against vehicle-borne explosive devices.
For the next decade, Al-Shabaab will continue to be a threat, and I think they will continue to launch these kind of suicide attacks. So, you know, expectations are that as we go forward, Somalia will continue to improve its countermeasures in basically detecting and interdicting these kind of VBIDs.
Abdi says that the internal security apparatus in the country needs to be strengthened, but notes that the task cannot be completed in a day. He also notes the attack happened days after Somalia's defense minister and army chief of staff resigned.
And there have been, I think, consistent reports of friction within the security services themselves. So it is quite plausible that, you know, there was a serious lapse of security largely brought about by this crisis. That is quite conceivable.
Abdi Rashid Hashi, executive director of the Mogadishu-based Heritage Institute for Policy Studies, believes that something positive needs to come from the situation.
So I think the government, can do better. And the first order of business is to, you know, use this anger and this agony to galvanize the Somali people for a common agenda and a common, you know, common interest.
The president has declared 3 days of mourning, announced that flags would be flown at half-mast, and responded to the call for donated blood. Former al-Shabaab commander Mukhtar Robo also donated blood, saying those who are behind this, whose fingerprints are on this, must refrain from shedding the blood of Muslims and repent. You are not going to go to paradise by killing innocents. More than 30 severely wounded patients were airlifted to Turkey Monday, including a VOA freelance reporter. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Here's a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, Ian. Authorities from South Sudan and northern Kenya say a South Sudanese student who was suspended for disciplinary issues at a school in Kenya killed six people and wounded more than a dozen others during that attack on the school in Lokichogio. They say the student rounded up other youth and attacked the school on Friday after being suspended. Kenyan officials described the attack as an isolated incident. The shooter, believed to be from South Sudan's Kapeta state, gunned down five students and a security guard at Lokichogio Africa Inland Church and Secondary School, according to officials. Kenyan authorities say the student was suspended after fighting with another student. School officials told the youth to return with his parents. A Lodwar district police officer says instead, the youth returned with a handful of friends and went on a shooting rampage. The commissioner of South Sudan's Losolia County says the shooter was then apprehended by police, but a mob wrestled the young man away from the officers and burned him alive. In Rumbek, officials say at least six people were killed and two others wounded during a shootout between police and youth from an armed militia group over the weekend. An eyewitness says the attack lasted about 3 hours. The witness says five police officers were killed, including a female officer, but state officials say only one policeman and one armed youth were killed in the incident. Rumbek resident Raphael McQuay says it began when two armed youth entered Rumbek town and a police officer tried to disarm one of those youths. When the young man refused the officer's order to throw down his weapon, he says the officer shot and killed him. He says the second young man tried to shoot the officer, who then ran to a nearby police station for cover. McQuay says the youth then mobilized and attacked the station, and fighting engaged for the next 3 hours. And finally, members of the National Dialogue Steering Committee say they fear fighting will continue across the country after former First Vice President Riek Machar refused to meet them in South Africa last week. It is the second time the group came to see Machar. One of the officials who traveled to South Africa to consult with him says the group believes that it will be difficult to end hostilities in South Sudan unless Machar is involved in the national dialogue. About 20 members of the Dialogue Steering Committee and Secretariat returned to Juba over the weekend after failing to meet with Machar. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, Carol. And that's our show for this Monday. We leave you with the song Public Enemy by Ross Corby.
The King of Israel seen Most High Joe Rastafari. And you don't know any time righteousness and consciousness come forward. People always want to kill it down seen. Bless the Most High. Original Rascal be life and direct. So Sudan is liberated. Yeah. Watch it.
You call me a public enemy because I'm fighting my enemy. Public.
He's a Chinese, I'm proud to be a Southern Sudanese.
They call me a public enemy because I'm fighting my enemy. Public enemy because I'm fighting my enemy.
Say, anytime I want to talk about my people's rights.
We've been listening to Ross Corby with the song Public Enemy. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. We're glad you could be here. We want to hear your comments about the show. Drop us a line on the web at southsudan@voanews.com, or you can find us on our Facebook site at South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
When our forefathers were taken across the Atlantic, it was a pity.